Hey, everybody. Today on the podcast, we have Walter Cruttenden, and we are talking about precession of the equinoxes and the astronomical cause of that phenomena. Because, as we all probably learned back in high school, this is generally a pattern thought to be caused by the wobble of the Earth's axis. But there's some problems with that.
Namely, the fact that precession can only be measured with stars that are fixed, meaning that they're outside of our solar system. And so anything that's inside the solar system is not experiencing the same precession, the same perceived precession from Earth, which suggests that there's a deeper, stranger story that's actually happening. Because if the Earth's axis is wobbling and causing precession, then you would expect you would be able to see that with the planets.
And so Walter's proposal, like many others who came before him, is that our sun perhaps has a binary partner that we are just unaware of. And as our sun makes motion with respect to that binary partner, this changes the background landscape of the constellations, resulting in the precession that we have inherited knowledge of since prehistory, essentially, right? The earliest records in history point to a tradition of being aware of this third cycle, not just the seasons, not just night and day, but another motion of our entire solar system. And that's what we are talking about today. And of course, there's this mythological tradition with the rise and fall of civilizations that the ancestors have pegged to this cycle. And so we try to sort of dissect those two aspects, the civilization level cycles and the astronomical cycles, and see to what extent are those related? Are they physically related? Are they analogous to one another? Is this the way that the ancient peoples told the stories about the rise and fall of their civilizations, or is there something more material to that hypothesis?
Before we get to the conversation, we have a couple things to mention. Number one is our very first conference. We are gathering in Austin, Texas on April 7th and 8th of this year, and it's going to be a fantastic 2 days of talks, of conversations, and of eclipse watching. So if you have the means and the desire to get together with people that share your interests, consider coming to Demysticon 2024. The link for that is right up here. So get your tickets now and join in to the very, very first gathering of everyone who's interested in the ideas that we discuss on the podcast.
Also, if you join our Patreon, you're going to get a significant discount on conference tickets. And we couldn't do this podcast without patrons. So thank you if you are already a patron. If you're not, consider just giving a couple dollars, especially if you want to see the quality of this show go up. You want to see us being able to put more and more time towards it, being able to get better guests. This is a lot of work. And really, a couple dollars from each one of you would completely power this operation to the absolute maximum that we can imagine. So we look forward to seeing you at the conference, at our weekly patron chat, and let's keep growing this thing.
For now, on to Walter Cruttenden.
The scientific revolution starts now.
Let us see in the dark.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to just dive right into this. This is something we've been thinking about a good deal. And precession and binary stars possibilities for our own solar system. Pretty far out, but there's some intriguing pieces of evidence too. And yeah, I want to just give you the floor to maybe introduce yourself and at least tell us
your theory.
What's your theory?
Huh? Your theory.
Tell us the theory and tell us why you even got interested in it in the first place, I guess, is something that's quite useful.
Because you're not an astrophysicist by history.
No, I've studied it for 30 years, but not by degree, that's for sure. In school, I mostly studied history, and it was actually history that got me interested in this theory of history that's driven by astronomical motion. And as I kind of dug into it, first as a little boy, my mom would buy me books, you know, on ancient civilizations, because I was always interested in that sort of thing. And then more formally into just studying physics and astronomy, I started to see that it could really be a possibility that the ancients might have been right, that there could actually be this grand cycle of time driven by the, you know, the changing cosmic motions. And indeed, that's the case with the smaller cycles that we see. As we mentioned before, the cycle of night and day is driven by the first celestial cycle, which is, you know, the stars go around us every single day. Everything rises in the east and sets in the west. And it's because the Earth rotates on its axis. But we're so adapted to that. You know, it literally causes our change in consciousness. We go from this waking state when the sun's out and a lot of activity and photosynthesis occurs, the whole planet lights up, to, you know, we go into a different state of consciousness at night, a subconscious state. And we believe that that's real in our dreams until we wake up again with the turning Earth. And so a celestial motion does drive this first cycle of time that affects us all, but it drives a second cycle, the cycle of the seasons. And so when I read that the ancients talked about a third cycle, a great year, Plato's great year, being driven by an astronomical motion, I had to find out everything I could about that astronomical motion. So that's how I got interested in precession.
And the ancients realized this third cycle astronomically by what means? So they were looking at the motion of the shift in the constellations and the location of the pole stars.
Hold on, before we get into this, I really want to give people like the overview of the idea, which is that we have precession of the equinoxes, which is that there is this 24,000 year cycle according to which the constellation that the sun rises in on the spring equinox shifts, and it's a cyclical shift. And so every 24,000 years, we return to the original constellation. And Milankovitch's explanation for precession is this, is it the axial wobble? I think it's the, is, Walter, help
the
me
lunar solar, the lunar solar.
Right. Theory, so, yes. So yes, we see three things when we look at the sky and observe it for a long period of time. The first thing we see is everything rises in the east and sets in the west. And of course, Copernicus told us and proved pretty effectively that that's because the Earth rotates. Everything really doesn't have to go around to us. The cosmos don't have to make that much effort. All we have to do is rotate and we see everything go around us. And then the second motion, he had to explain to sort of set off the Copernican revolution in the, you know, with the beginning of the Renaissance, was why the sun moves through different constellations through the year. And of course, he told us that the Earth orbits the sun. And this was sort of heretical thought at the time, you know, because the church and the main belief system was, no, the Earth's not moving. I don't feel it move. It couldn't be moving. You know, physics wasn't very well understood, principles of inertia, things like that. But he used some math and science to kind of show that, no, it's the Earth orbiting the sun. And he actually got that idea from an ancient text, Aristarchus of Samos, who lived around 300 to 400 BC, so almost 2,000 years before Copernicus had come up with this idea, and then it went away during the Dark Ages, and Copernicus was resurrecting it. And then, yes, he had to explain a third thing, and that is why, if the sun is immovable at the center of the universe, he said, why, when we look just on the equinox, and you can use the spring equinox or the fall equinox, why does the sun move through the constellations at the rate of about 50 arc seconds per year backwards to the rate it moves during the year? So it was really something that people were aware of, because, you know, people have been observing the sky for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And he said, well, the only thing I could think of is the Earth's axis must wobble. And if it moves a little bit, then when we get to that same point on the equinox, we're actually not looking at the same stars. We're looking at a different portion of sky. And so, yeah, he called that libration or wobble, but he didn't have a reason for it. And so it wasn't until Newton came along, roughly 140 years after Copernicus. I think Copernicus published in 1543, and Newton's, you know, around late 1600s, 1680 roughly. And Newton's saying, well, if the axis does wobble, it must be due to the gravity of the sun and the moon tugging on the Earth, because the Earth's a little bit oblate. And so it's not being a perfect spheroid, it would have a little bit of axial wobble. And so that was the theory that Newton put forth to explain it. And you're right about the timing there, Anastasia. It's roughly 24 to 26,000 years. And it's not exact, because the precession rate has been accelerating every year. So at first, everyone thought, well, it's 25,920 years, because that's 50 arc seconds per year. If you divide a circle by 1,296,000 arc seconds by 50, you come up with, you know, that 25,920. But people notice the precession rate is speeding up, 50.1, 50.2, 50.3 over the last few hundred years. And so the time it takes to complete a cycle goes from 25,900 to 25,800 to 25,700. So the cycle time is shrinking. And so it's just one little facet of a precession that can help us understand its cause later on. But it was Newton who said it must be due to the gravity of the sun and the moon. And he said that you know, he actually didn't say it. It just, people said, okay, well, that must account for all of the wobble. So people just assumed it counted for all of it, all 50 arc seconds. And, but Newton's equations really didn't work very well. Laplace came along later and found out there were problems, and other people, and they started adding in things and said, instead of just the sun and the moon, you know, the lunisolar forces, it's Jupiter, it's Venus has some effect. And then that didn't quite work. You know, 50 years would go by, they'd look at the sky, gee, the precession rate's speeding up, and it can't be, and therefore there must be other factors at work. And so this goes on and on and on. Every 40, 50 years, they're adding things in. And the latest precession formula now has about 3,000 inputs to it, you know, atmospheric conditions and stuff like this. But an interesting thing happened along the way, that nobody cares about precession anymore. And the reason is, at one time when you navigated a ship across the oceans, you needed to know exactly where the stars were, especially if you're, you know, you're Captain Cook and you're going thousands of miles over open ocean. You want to know where you are, and therefore you have to know exactly where the stars are. And if the axis is wobbling, that's a little tough. And so they used the precession input into navigation formulas. But by, of course, the early 1900s, you know, radios coming along, and then radar, and then computers and satellites, and nobody cares about precession anymore. And so the fact that the equation doesn't quite work is of no interest to anybody, you know. And so it's kind of become unimportant, and yet it's the third motion of the Earth. And we know there's these huge cycles attached to the first two motions. So I think we should understand the third motion, and that's why I'm dedicating my life to studying it. you know, even though I'm not using it for navigation purposes, but I think it can actually help us navigate life in a bigger way when we really understand the consequences of this motion.
So let me get this straight. This idea is thousands of years old. Even the mechanistic scientific explanation goes all the way back to Aristarchus and Hipparchus. Is that correct? Like the idea that there's a wobble that accounts for this third cycle? Is that that's something that the Copernicus resurrected?
So Hipparchus is credited with being the first person to discover precession and know about it and talk about it, write a little bit about it. And I think he goes back right around to from the BC AD era, maybe 100 BC, something like that. Don't test me on that one, but right in there. And then, yeah, people kind of forgot about it during the Dark Ages, but got back to it around Copernicus's time. And then in the last few hundred years, measured it very carefully when they needed to. And now again, not too many people care about it. But long before Hipparchus, you know, the great Greek, many cultures talked about precession. They didn't call it precession per se, but they talked about it as a motion of the heavens. And you find this in, you know, Mesopotamian writings, Polynesians are obviously, they're navigating seas by the stars. They really have it figured out. Even the Indians, ancient Indians, you know, and they call this cycle the Yuga cycle. One complete precession of the equinox is one complete Yuga cycle.
And do they refer to that in astronomical terms, like in years? Do they make predictions about the length of that?
They refer to it as a 24,000 year cycle. So it's very close to the today's precession thing, within 10%, say. But and then they give some detail to break it into sort of sections, you know, just like the Greeks do. Greeks break it into the iron, bronze, silver, and golden age long before Hipparchus. So did the Indians break it into the Kali Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, Treta Yuga, and Satya Yuga. And so, yeah, you find it all over the world, and they relate it to a motion of the stars, but they don't know or always say why the stars are moving around us. It was really Copernicus. Western science said, well, it must be the Earth wobbling. Copernicus saying that, Newton saying, well, if that's the case, then it's probably due to these big objects. And of course, that hasn't, it's never been precise. And
now, aside from the precision, are there other problems with that model that, you know?
Which model, sorry?
The lunisolar wobble theory or whatever, add however many planets you want onto it. Are there other problems with it?
Yes. Yeah. No, there's a huge problem, which not that many people are aware of, again, because very few people study it or care about it. But the biggest problem is that that precession seems to occur relative to objects outside the solar system, but not relative to objects inside the solar system.
We actually Shiloh just discovered that this morning.
Yeah, one thing I love to do with alternative theories is just go over and pick people's brains on Stack Exchange, because that's kind of where all the mainstream physicist nerds hang out at. And nobody had a response to that one, which I thought was really, really interesting. That seems like a real death blow to this theory, as far as like to the mainstream theory of axial wobble. How do you possibly explain that? Have you heard people try to explain that one away?
The only way it's explained away is that you can't really use objects that are in the solar system to measure, because everything's moving too much, you know. So you want to use things as far away as you can when you measure the Earth's motion. And that's why they use quasars, pulsars, you know, VLBI, very long baseline interferometry, to look at these things that are not only outside our solar system, but outside our galaxy. Because, you know, the farther away something is, even if it's moving, it's going to look like a still point to you. And so I totally agree. Yes, that's better for measurement purposes. But if you actually do measure it relative to something within the solar system, you don't see precession.
Yeah, like the plane of the ecliptic should be stable, right? If you trace out the path of all of the planets, you can average them. And it seems like the planets should also be rising and setting in different locations with respect to their own orbital patterns, which have been documented for thousands of years, going back to the Sumerian star catalogs, right?
Yeah, the Sumerians and the ancient Egyptians, you know, we still don't understand everything they were doing. They have all these star motifs on some of these hieroglyphic walls, and nobody completely understands what they're doing, other than we know that they're plotting the stars. Yes.
But there's, I guess my point is that there's ample record of the motion of and the orbits of the planets and their positions in the sky and so forth. You would think that that would be affected by precession as well, or at least have popped out.
Yeah, because I'm like, look, if you have a sufficiently parameterized model that you can have hundreds and hundreds of factors that you've included to say that this is what's causing precession, and then when somebody's like, hey, but the planets don't appear to be moving, and you're like, well, that's just far too complicated for us to include. You can't really measure that. That just seems kind of like a cop-out.
Thank you. This is why I like talking to real scientists, you know, PhDs that understand, you know, because, yeah, there's so many areas of study. People, most astronomers I talk to, they just say, you know, that's an interesting problem. It's not my area of expertise. Yeah. You know, people are into plasma physics or black holes or dark matter, dark energy, all these exotic things. And classical mechanics is thought to be completely mastered, understood. And so even if there is a little problem, it really can't be that important, right?
And, maybe not, right? Yeah. That's actually that's one of my cringe responses is when somebody tells me that they don't have the authority to comment on something. I'm like, all right, well, you're excused. Like, now tell me what you really think, you know? It's like, I understand this isn't your professional opinion, but let's at least think here as human beings, not as experts, but just let's think about this, you know?
I just think that people have a sense that it's impossible that we have missed such basic things. And I understand that, because to live in a world that makes sense and to live in a world where you can look around and you could look at all of our science and be like, we're very technologically advanced, we're very wise, you have to assume that the basics are right. You have to assume that there will not be another revolution in the diagram of the solar system, that there will not be any great moment where we suddenly realize that, you know, as they did with the Cepheid variables in the 20s, where they were like, hey, hold on a second, I think that the universe isn't just the Milky Way.
Yeah. I think there's something else to this too, which is that there might not have been an adequate replacement theory. And I think that it's very difficult to kick the legs out from underneath some paradigm, scientific, social, political, whatever, unless you have a better alternative in mind. And that seems to be where we're at, right? Because there's no
nail on the head.
Yeah. There's no obvious. Well, you might think there's an obvious candidate, but for most people, most astrophysicists you talk to, there's not an obvious candidate for something that would account for this, right?
Right. Yeah, it's a reference frame issue. You know, we all have different reference frames, and if we're all in a car together going 60 miles an hour, you know, there's no motion between us. We're in the same moving reference frame. But so what's happening, in my opinion, is that the solar system is moving, and you know, things outside the solar system, you cannot measure the Earth that's in a moving reference frame, the solar system, relative to something far outside the solar system, and just say that that's reality, because you've failed to account for the fact you're in a moving vehicle, the solar system. And so that's why you see precession relative to things outside the solar system, but not inside the solar system, because precession is caused by the solar system moving. That's what precession is, the whole solar system moving. And I'm not saying that's 100% a precession or that the Earth's axis doesn't wobble at all, because I do see a little bit of noise in there, but it doesn't appear to be any more than about 2 arc seconds. Therefore, the bulk of the 50 arc seconds every year is actual solar system motion, and only a little bit of it is axial wobble.
And the idea of the solar system being in motion is not just a linear motion, say, moving through the Milky Way galaxy. This is actually a proposal that the sun is part of a binary star system, and it's orbiting another star, which, do you guys know, do you have a proposal for what's...
Before we move on, like, to be fair to the innovators of this idea, they didn't really know about galaxies and the motion. They didn't really think of the solar system as moving. Right, because they just got done fighting this battle to put the sun at the center of the universe, essentially.
Right.
And so, to be like perfectly fair to them, they had no concept of what we now understand is the solar system's motion through the galaxy, through the different spiral arms. These are pretty modern ideas.
They didn't even know that there were binary star systems up until like 40 years ago, maybe?
Yeah, but even before binaries, right? Even before considering the mechanism for it. Like, they couldn't even consider the motion of the star, of our star, right? That's pretty mind-bending. That's a totally different paradigm than the way we look at things today. And then, binaries.
If you read Copernicus, he's trying to establish the sun as the center of the universe.
Right.
You know, there's no concept of galaxies, you know, local stellar neighborhoods, interstellar clusters, anything, solar systems, they don't have those concepts at all. And so, yes, that's the foundation on which modern astronomy is built. And so it's been a lot of sort of patching and tweaking from there. Anastasia, you mentioned Hubble in the 1920. Yeah, he really brought us to this next level. That's not just a smudge within our one universe. Those are like different island universes. Those are different galaxies out there. And that alone opened our eyes.
Hey folks, just a quick interruption to let you know that we absolutely depend on listener support to make this project happen, to give more and more time to it, and to ratchet up the production level for the show. Spend more time finding the guests that we all want to hear from. And we need your help. So please come over to patreon.com and join our community. We get together once a week, have a roundtable discussion. It's a really, really special environment, and you can come and join us for a donation of as little as a couple dollars a month. So, see you there, and here's a link.
But so, to get back to this point, I think there's multiple reference frames that precession, per se, is largely caused by our sun's motion around a nearby stellar object, a very close star. And then there's, you know, no doubt motion around the local stellar neighborhood with a group of stars. And then that cluster goes around the whole galaxy. And of course, the galaxies are all moving out from each other faster than anyone can believe right now. So it's a big, complicated universe.
When did this binary idea first come on the scene? When did people realize that a lot of stars had companions, and when did, you know, anybody even begin to entertain the idea that our sun might have a partner?
Yes. So I think, you know, 100 years ago when people looked up at and saw two stars very close together, they just thought it was two stars close together. It was only after telescopes became prevalent and pretty good, and people took constant observations to realize, oh, the star is actually moving around the other star. And so that's, you know, in the last 100 years, the top astronomers realized that, and it's become part of the sort of the mainstream understanding, say, in the last 40 or 50 years. And it's only probably in the last 20 years that people have realized that the majority of stars are actually in these relationships. You know, either it's a bunch in a cluster, or it's, you know, two, three, or four, but most are just two. And And even then, the number was below the majority until they realized these small red dwarfs, and they could see better. And now when we see a bright star, you kind of zoom in closer, and you often find a red dwarf or a brown dwarf and realize, oh, they have a partner too. It's just a, you know, harder to see partner. And so the latest estimate I heard was around 80%, and that's on the Chandra website.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, even some of the closest stars to us aren't visible, right, with the naked eye at least. You have to, you know, at least have some high magnification, but probably some infrared telescopes as well. And these are just not things that would have occurred to people a few hundred years ago.
Like the closest stars are just dim?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I think it's quite a few. I want to say, well, I don't know the percentage off the top of my head, but of the nearest stars to us, a good portion of them are invisible to the naked eye.
Yes, and we think that the candidate to be our sun's companion star that is gravitationally bound to another star is one that isn't seen with the naked eye, but one that science discovered about 100 years ago or so.
Which star is this?
This is a Barnard star.
Okay.
We think it's the best candidate. And but you had asked me first about, you know, where did this idea sort of come from? I was actually reading a book. It's called The Holy Science. It's by Swami Sri Yukteswar. And it's about the whole of science, you know, the holy science. He's trying to put together, he's from India, and so he's trying to put together sort of Eastern science with Western science, sort of a spiritual science with a material science. And he thinks that's very important. And he's talking about the yugas and, you know, the rise and fall of consciousness over long periods of time. And he just sort of mentions in passing that, you know, this book may be difficult to understand at the current moment because we're in a low age. And the reason we're in a low age is because our star is currently far from its partner star. And then he has a little, just one sentence in there, and said, you know, that moons go around planets, and planets with their moons go around stars. And our star, our sun, with its planets, goes around a nearby star, which produces the backward motion of the equinoctial point. He doesn't take credit for it. He just says, according to Oriental astronomy. So it's pretty ancient stuff, because this book itself is written in 1894. And so that's what I thought, oh, well, let's test that. You know, let's really build a model of the current precession theory, and we'll build a model of our sun going around another nearby star. And we found that, you know, we only need like five or six inputs to do this model that Sri Yukteswar is talking about. And yet it's 43 times more accurate, we found, you know, and predicting precession over the last few hundred years versus what we find in the astronomical almanac, the actual precession readings. So it's amazing. And that's what kind of what got me on it. But he never mentioned what the other star was. And so we went on this long search, you know, over 20 years or so to look at everything. And there's just a lot more information out in the last few years. And at the time that he wrote this book, Barnard's star was not known. It wasn't discovered until 1915, 1916 by a Western science. So this book was written, you know, 20, 21 years before that.
Which is really,
of course he couldn't name
it's
it.
Kind of mind-bending, I think, to most people that, because Barnard's star is one of the closest stars to us, for sure, right? I think that's really shocking that we could have stars right up on our backyard and not know about them. I think that would be a huge shock to most people.
How far are we talking?
I think 5 or 6 light years.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think the AA gives a definition right now of about 6, but The latest is about 5.9. And yeah, so the closest star system is Alpha Centauri. There's Alpha Centauri A, Alpha Centauri B, and Proxima Centauri. And they're, that little cluster is between 4.2 and 4.4 light years. And so that's considered the closest. Well, it is the closest that we know of right now. And so, yeah, the Barnard star would actually be the second closest star. But, of course, it wasn't known until last 100 years or so.
And it's not a puny star, right? Isn't it something like several times the size of our sun?
No, it's smaller than our sun.
Smaller? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's about 17% of the mass.
Okay, it's tiny.
But yeah, but it's still, you know, 50,000 Earth masses. And it's interesting because when we started looking at the Binary Research Institute for a possible companion to our sun, nobody was looking for anything like this. And, you know, everything was fine with the solar system. And then when Mike Brown and Constantine Batygin at Caltech and some other astronomers realized that, oh, they're finding all these dwarf stars that are, dwarf planets that are small Pluto size, and it caused them to sort of reclassify our planetary system. Remember, we all grew up with 9 planets. They said, no, there's only 8 classical planets because we're finding so many dwarfs, we can't even add them in every year into the textbooks. And so they're the ones that realized after they'd found half a dozen of those that, my God, they're all very similar. They have elongated orbits. They're all inclined to the plane, and they all have their perihelions, their closest approach to the sun, on one side of the sun. And so this is when, you know, 2015, 2016, there was a big buzz and said, you know, what is this all about? And are we correct in these observations? And so by 2017, the Caltech guys were saying there must be a large mass out there, and that's when the official search for Planet Nine began. And so that's part of the story, that, you know, we were sort of the lone wolf looking for something, and then they came out and they said they were 100% sure there has to be a mass out there that's affecting our solar system, because otherwise you need like 5 different explanations to explain all these things. And, amazingly, you know, with our tremendous telescopes today, our great technology, our computers that can, you know, put all these plates together, these photographs, and look at them and therefore see things move, they haven't been able to find it. And that was totally unexpected. As you probably know, you know, when they realized that Uranus was acting strange, they found Neptune pretty quickly after doing the math. And when they noticed that Neptune was acting strange, they found Pluto pretty quickly. And so now they find the whole solar system's acting strange. They figured they'd find something pretty quickly, especially with the instruments we have today. And that's why it's just an amazing time here, that all these great astronomers think there has to be something, and yet all we're hearing is crickets.
Have you had a chance to talk to Batygin about this? Because we had him on the show probably like a year ago at this point, and he seems like he'd be pretty open to the possibility of Barnard's star being involved somehow.
You know, I wrote him an email, but just kind of left it at that. So no, I haven't talked to him. You know, I was up on the campus not too long ago at Caltech, and I should have just reached out then, but I'll go back and do it. But yeah, I'd love him to look seriously at it, because I think it's a solution to what they're looking for. It's just kind of it's a big leap for them, because besides this being the thing that they're looking for, and it really does fit, you know, they're looking for 5 to 10 Earth masses, but 170 AU out. This is 50,000 Earth masses much farther out, but it all has about the same effect. And so I think it really fits. But they also have to then grab this idea that precession has a totally different cause.
It's one of the most interesting things, because we talk to people who are, you know, astrophysicists, people at NASA, and everyone universally, when we propose that, you know, theories warrant changing, is like, well, if there was good evidence for it, people would definitely jump on it because everybody wants to win a prize or they want to become known for a theory. And yet there's this really interesting tension of not looking too closely at ideas that don't come from inside of academic patterns.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's that way in politics, business, everything. Yeah. If you don't come from the approved source, then yeah, you don't get much of a voice. That's okay.
Can we talk about what makes Barnard's star particularly attractive? Because what I understand, it has some appreciable motion, which is quite unique.
I was actually I'm going to step away for a second and grab our Chromebook.
Yeah, go ahead.
Some stuff up. Sure. But you guys you keep talking. I'll be right back.
Okay. So
it has some exceptional proper motion from what I understand.
Yes. It's considered the fastest star in the sky.
Mm.
And there may be other stars that are temporarily faster, you know, moving around, whipping by a black hole or something like that. But it's sort of a steady state, fastest star known, and certainly in the local area. When you ask people, well, why is Barnard's moving so quickly? They will say, any object that's really close to us will have a higher relative motion. And that is true, of course. You know, if you're right next to a car that's going by, it's going to appear to go, you know, very fast from right view to left view versus 1,000 miles away. You know, you barely see it moving. But even so, Barnard's star is moving much faster than Alpha Centauri. And Alpha Centauri is much closer. You know, it's about two-thirds the distance that Barnard's star is right now. And yet it's only going about one-third the speed. So it's not just relative distance alone that's causing this high proper motion. So there's got to be another reason. And if you talk to astronomers, physicists out there, they will tell you properly that yes, when any object goes by another object, it'll get a gravitational boost or jump. And this is how we fling satellites out there, Voyager, Pioneer, et cetera. They went by Jupiter or Saturn to get to the outer universe and save time and energy. And so Barnard's star, it's agreed that it must have gone close to something in the not too distant past, you know, 10, 20,000 years, something like that. It came close to another star, and it's still showing some of that acceleration. But here's the most interesting thing about it. If it did come close to something, yes, that would speed it up, but then that it would slowly be, you know, decelerating now. And the latest paper I've seen is that Barnard's is still accelerating, you know, it's moving faster. And so it's not only the fastest moving star in the sky, but it's moving faster. And that tells you, you know, when two stars or two planets, two objects are gravitationally bound, when they're at their closest points, they're moving fastest because gravity is the strongest. And when they're at, you know, apoapsis versus periapsis, they're at their farthest point and they're moving slowest. So whatever Barnard's is moving closer to, it's you know, it should be going in that direction.
It should be nearby, it seems like, right? And so much as the thing is approaching.
Very nearby.
And there's, of course, the parallel, too, with the precession, right? Which seems to have this acceleration at the moment.
Exactly, yes. And this is why precession needs to be part of the conversation. And you get a twofer here, you know. You not only get to solve this thing that's tugging on our universe and elongating all the dwarf planets, but you also explain precession. And so, yeah, I think it's just amazing.
Is anybody actively publishing on Bernard's star at the moment? Like, are people making predictions for what will happen? Because I assume that people think it's just going to fly off into the distance eventually.
I found that there's about 400 papers on Bernard's star since 2020, but most of them are just trying to characterize it. And there's some proposal that there's maybe like a super Earth-sized planet that's orbiting it, but then other people are like, no, y'all are idiots and there's nothing there. And so it seems like I'm perplexed by how difficult it is to even evaluate this given the tools that we have.
Yes, yeah. So Bernard's has been popular. It's in the game world lexicon, you know. Several games use the planet around Bernard's star as a, you know, place that aliens might have come from and things like this. And so, yeah, it's cool. But yeah, people aren't really looking at it as a companion star. They're just, but recently people have talked more and more about, it's interesting that it's actually almost coming straight towards us. And of course, it's assumed that it will fly by because it's assumed that we're not in a binary system. But if we're in a binary system, then obviously it won't fly by. It'll bend us and it itself will bend around us. And, you know, two stars in a binary system have a common center of mass. Well, any two objects, the Earth and the Moon, have a common center of mass. And so they'll go around that point. And we think that that point will, you know, probably be less than a light year away. And so it's, you don't need crazy speeds or new physics or anything to explain this. You just need pretty much the solar system to be going the speed that it's moving and Bernard's to be going the speed that we see it moving right now.
At that closest approach, how close would that put us to Bernard's star? Because the light year is basically still inside of our solar system, from what I understand.
So a light year is well outside our solar system.
I guess not. If you call the Oort cloud the outer limits of the solar system, perhaps not.
Yeah. Okay. So you're pushing the boundaries there.
I don't know. I'm just thinking that seems really close to me. You know.
I've always thought that the Oort cloud is the if. This is a little bit loopy, but if the star systems are cells, or can be analogized to cells, that the Oort cloud would be the farthest reach of the sphere of influence. It would be kind of the membrane through which things need to pass in order to enter into the area of the sun's influence.
I like that thinking. So there's a few issues here. So Bernard's, the mainstream says that it will be our closest star, you know, in roughly 10,000 years, which is coincidentally the time when Sri Yukteswar says that our companion star will be at its closest point. And the mainstream puts that estimate, I think right now at about 3.8 light years, 3.7 light years. And so that's closer than Alpha Centauri is right now. Now, Alpha Centauri itself might be coming closer too at the same time. So there's no Bible on this. This is just, you know, current estimates. But that, yeah, that was only really recognized in the last 2 years or so because, you know, I'd been talking to astronomers casually for 10 years and they give me this list. Okay, well, if we aren't a companion, if we do have a companion star, it's got to be the closest star. And so, you know, Bernard never made the list because of that. And then, so it's nice to have that checked off. It's got to be the fastest star. Well, Bernard's clicking that one off. And and a few other things.
Well, what's really interesting about that 3.6 light years distance is the influence of those two stars would be overlapping significantly at that point. And so, you know, the Oort cloud, you know, it's still relatively theoretical, but we do need a reservoir for all of these comets, right? And so when we try to tie this astronomical story into the history of the Earth and the cycles of civilization and so forth, all of a sudden you do have the possibility of interactions, right? Of dislodging bodies which could come and become a threat or change the climate here on Earth. And obviously, from what I can tell, most civilizations have fallen because of some form of climate changing or some economic stress. And so you really start to see the possibilities for what could influence life on Earth, right? Obviously, night and day affects whether we sleep or not. You know, the seasons affect how we grow our crops. Well, if there's cycles of let's say, impacts or
inundation
or disturbances to the atmosphere, what was that?
Or inundation.
Yeah, inundation in general. Tsunamis, you know, most of the Earth's covered in water, so impacts don't necessarily have to destroy a city for it to be a threat, right? They can influence everything widely, these impacts. Even if they don't impact the ground, even if they just explode in the sky, this can cause all sorts of havoc to the ecosystem and so forth.
Well, the Oort cloud, right. There's a huge range for how big it's supposed to be, but basically they're suggesting that it ranges from a distance of 0.03 to 3.2 light years. And so
and like assuming that the other star, Bernard's star, has an Oort cloud too, now you have an interesting churning situation. I feel like I've asked Batygin about this, or who was the last guy we had from Caltech? I asked somebody about this churning and they were like, well, the Oort clouds are so rarefied that, you know, you could mix them together and not have them crash into each other. But
it's just like, maybe, but I think that it's significant that you have these cycles that civilization began roughly 12,000 years ago. Like that's the point where we can look to and we're like, okay, Göbekli Tepe is getting built up 12,000 years ago. And we're missing time in between Göbekli Tepe and, say, Sumeria, but I think that that's just a problem of having dug stuff up, because the way that we tend to find these ancient civilizations is that somebody's like, hey, I found this weird chunk of pottery. And then somebody shows up and they start digging and they're like, by God, a city.
Well, the water really started flowing after that point too, from what I understand, right? Sea level rise. And there's not a lot of scientists who are also certified divers, so the likelihood of excavating random places off the coast seems expensive and untenable.
That's definitely true, but it's okay. So if it is a 12,000-year cycle, you're saying that Barnard's star is going to be on its closest approach in another 10,000 years?
Yes, roughly 10,500 years. So the closest point before this would have been roughly 11,500 BC. And then the farthest point is 500 AD, which is near the depth of the Dark Ages. You know, every great civilization has collapsed. Egypt, Sumeria, the Indus Valley, you know, Greece and Rome finally giving up the ghost. And this cycle of the yugas, the rise and fall of history, fits very well with this cycle of our companion star. Graham Hancock's a good friend. As you probably know, we have this conference every year, the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge. And so we always have dinner. And he's really totally into this, as you know, this idea that there was some great cataclysm, and that's what his show Ancient Apocalypse is about, that happened roughly when this Bernard's would have been near its closest point, and therefore, yes, possibly dislodged something in the Oort cloud that comes close to us, you know, within that couple thousand year period, it knocked something out.
Now, is that in conflict with the idea that that should have been the Golden Age?
I don't think so. You know, according to the yugas of ancient Indians, I really like their writings because they have so much detail on it. The Greeks give this real cursory summary of what each age is like, but the Indians get into detail, and it's all about consciousness. And consciousness is really having fun in the higher ages, you know, and we're much less attached to these physical bodies. You know, just in the Silver Age alone, telepathy is supposed to be common knowledge once again, you know. So, I think, you know, things, physical things that happen on Earth, probably, you know, the consciousness cycle doesn't have to sync with that. Matter of fact, wouldn't it be fun if you're an absolute master and you can witness this unbelievable cataclysm coming to Earth? But that's getting a little speculative.
Yeah, I'm just trying to tie it together. I'm trying to tie the astronomical to the civilization level swings, because that's the thing that I'm having the hardest time with, is understanding how the presence of a star is going to affect ongoings on Earth at a cultural elevation level, right? I mean, I see that when there is no civilization, it can be a very hard and short life for most people. And there probably isn't a lot of time aside from maybe one guy in your tribe or your community who is the shaman to really devote themselves to, you know, metaphysical issues and, let's say, thinking about how to treat each other better, how to live better, how to progress society, eventually civilization. But once you have civilization, you get specialization. At this point, people are unbelievable. We're so comfortable that, you know, number one disease in the West is obesity, right? People have so much. And that gives space for things like contemplation, intellectual pursuits, arts, things that we think of as spiritually elevating, ideal, at least in their ideal form. But those seem to be, I'm just trying to correlate those two with the motion of this star, because it seems like we're on the rise with those things at the moment, greater than ever before.
The rise of art?
The rise of civilization. It seems like we're at a high watermark of civilization. Would you agree?
I mean, it's hard to say, right? Because on one hand, we have tons of technology and we have this ability to fly across the world in hours and
have Zoom calls and, you know, access the whole history of information from my pocket and so forth.
But it does
We've
seem
really
like
come a long way since the depth of dark ages, no question.
Yeah, right?
Technologically.
But there also seems to be a fracturing of people's hearts and minds, right? I saw this really, really interesting excerpt from a book the other day that was talking about how during the last World War, almost all of the psychiatric institutions in Europe emptied out. Like, there was people who were schizophrenics during peacetime were driving ambulances during wartime. Like, there's something about the pressure.
They had a purpose.
Right? And so I feel like we are advanced but purposeless, and people just don't know what to do with themselves. And so if there is a high watermark for civilization, I would feel like a high watermark comes with great purpose. Because
okay,
what do we have? Just toys?
Yeah. All right, so let's get into history, because that's where we started. That's why we look for the explanation of precession and the binary star. And let me offer this this book. So this is a children's book I wrote. It's called The Great Year. It's just the basics on history according to the Yuga cycle. And down at the bottom is when we're farthest from our sun. So that's last occurred about 500 AD or so. And at that point, all the great civilizations have fallen, as we talked about, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Indus, Sumer falls to Akkad falls to Babylon. And by the time of the Dark Ages, you know, it's just nomads in tents. They can't build anything. It's really ridiculous how far people have fallen. And it's not due to just some catastrophe 11,000 years ago, because all those great civilizations came in between. So there's something else that's affecting consciousness. And up here, at the top, you know, according to the Greeks and the Indians and a couple others, that's when we have the golden age, and that's when we're closest to this other star. And so, yeah, I think that there's something that's affecting consciousness outside of cataclysms, you know, that just interrupt whatever the trend is at the time. That it's almost like, you know, during the day we have, when the light comes, we all perform better and plants are productive and, you know, we can think more clearly because we're not asleep. And so there's, I think it's a force we really don't understand yet. There's some sort of subtle energy effects from another star. And I'm not saying it's Bernard's star. What Sri Yukteswar himself says is we go around this other star, you get closer to it and farther from it. But that's actually the action which is bringing us to another point in space, which he calls Vishnu Nabhi, the seat of Brahma, where it gives rise to virtue and clear conscience and high consciousness.
Pardon the interruption, but before you go, I just wanted to take a moment to remind you to purchase tickets for our very first scientific conference, Demysticon 2024. It's going to be held in Austin, Texas on April 7th and 8th to coincide with the total solar eclipse that is passing through there. We have about a minute and 30 seconds of totality for us on Monday, and the rest of the time we're going to spend exploring ideas as a community. And we really hope to see you in Austin because I think it's going to be a really special event. For now, back to the conversation.
And so the Greeks give us these easy ways to understand it. In the lowest age, it's an iron age. You only know what you can perceive through your five senses because the sixth sense is dead. It's gone. And so you think everything is very, very material. And it was that way up until just, you know, just the last couple hundred years that we finally discovered this whole world of subtle energies, electricity and magnetism. Everything's made out of cells or molecules, and these are made out of atoms, and they're made out of electrons, protons, neutrons, etc. And that there's huge amount of spaces between there. So there really isn't any matter. You know, it's like this whole new paradigm occurs as we go from the Kali Yuga, the lowest, this Iron Age, into the Bronze Age. And this Bronze Age, which is going to unfold for another few thousand years, is supposed to be an age of tremendous technological advancement. And what is technology? It's just a manifestation of our cleverness. Our consciousness is increasing, so we can build things we couldn't build before. We can know things we couldn't know before. We can see through telescopes things that we could never see. We could see through microscopes things that we could never see. And so that goes on for a few thousand years. And then you have the next age, the Silver Age, the Treta Yuga, according to the Indians. And that is an age of the mental age, age of telepathy. And the last images of that exist on Earth today would be called a pre-Babel age. It's before God confused the tongues, you know, in the Christian vernacular. And mankind lived in tune with nature. And Hesiod, the great Greek historian, roughly, you know, 1700 BC, somewhere in there, tells us that the earth gave of herself freely. You know, we lived in such virtue and harmony that it's wonderful. And he laments the times that are coming, you know. The old Babylonian scriptures, you know, in cuneiform, we find they're aware that they're in a down cycle and they're concerned about it. And they're dead right. You know, we go from these great cities of ancient Sumeria to just nothingness by the time of the Dark Ages. So, yeah, there's that age. Unfortunately, we can't understand. We don't have the consciousness now in this conversation to perceive of the higher ages, but the little myth and folklore that we do have about wizards and amazing miracles, you know, we just can't believe them because they just don't fit with our, we've just barely out of the gross material age. We're just starting to discover, you know, higher forms of consciousness. And so that's my view of history, that it's really driven by consciousness much more than outer events and cataclysms.
Yeah, because there's two different ways of looking at ancient mythology, right? One is that the ancient peoples had a great deal of wisdom at some points, and from their overwhelming experience on Earth, right? They were preserving these ancient, let's say, ways that humans should behave, the way that consequence enacts itself, right? If you behave this way, this will happen, you know? And they tell these stories, and they use the planets, and they use the constellations to memorialize and illustrate, right? It's almost like their PowerPoint while they're telling these stories. And the idea that civilization, or let's say human consciousness, because these are two very different ideas, that they would have a natural progression to them seems in some sense unquestionable. It seems like civilizations rise and fall. People, you know, become enlightened and they fall into darkness. This certainly happens. In terms of pegging them, those two together, I don't know. Like, I don't know if that's even as important as the recognition that these cycles are important for human progression. And that now, like you say, we've reached this technological maximum, but do we know how to responsibly behave with all of this newfound power, right? Well, does having the ability to manipulate the environment, to make yourself comfortable, does that actually solve all your problems, or does it make a new set of problems? And if it does, then, which it does seem to be doing, right, with the, you know, all of the social issues we have today as a result of social media and instant connectedness, but at the same time, people are more isolated than ever before. People don't spend as much time in real life with their friends that they used to when I was a kid, for instance. So that's a whole new set of challenges. So it's not, I guess this is a bit rambly, but I'm trying to say that I'm not sure that technological civilizational level progress is necessarily pegged to conscious enlightenment at the same time. They seem to be out of phase at times.
Because like power without values is basically, you know, the character of Lenny and of Mice and Men, like squeezing the bunny to death.
Yes, there's wonderful problems to solve in today's world. You know, there's so many opportunities for each of us to be a hero. Oftentimes the Bronze Age is called the hero age, you know, in Greek mythology. And so, yeah, we're going through that. And if you think about it, technology is sort of comes out there developed by the brightest minds, the people that are sort of on the edge of higher consciousness, you know, Steve Jobs and Elon Musk and people like this. And we have a free market system, so it gets out into the marketplace pretty quickly and efficiently nowadays. And it is beyond the capabilities, the consciousness of the ordinary person to responsibly use, and it makes for a gloriously interesting world full of problems. And I just think that's the nature of the times that we live in. So yeah, we're rising in consciousness, and it's manifesting in our technology. But just as we have this ability to cause problems, we also have this higher consciousness to think of solutions too. And man, I find it so fun. Yogananda, who was a disciple of Sri Yukteswaras, who wrote that book, and you know, well known to Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs gave out Yogananda's book at his funeral. It's the only book he had on his iPad. He used to say that, you know, the Dwapara Yuga is a dangerous time because mankind's coming from this material age, so he still is creating all these material things with his higher consciousness, but he doesn't yet have the responsibility of you know, the higher ages. But he said, don't worry, it only lasts a couple thousand years, and then you're through it.
Something that I think that needs to be invented in order to shuffle us through into the next age is an economic system that works better than the one that we have right now. Shiloh pointed out something really interesting the other day, which was that, you know, when there's a lot of transition towards digital currencies. And in order to transition towards digital currencies, you
and credit-based economy, you know,
and finance. Credit-based economies, like finance economies. And in order to transition to those, you have to have an infrastructure, and the people who maintain the infrastructure will sometimes take a fraction of each transaction. And so when you used cash and you say you had $50 and you paid $50 for all of your goods and services, that $50, yeah, there were taxes that were taken out of it at each step, but that was the only amount that was removed from the transaction. And so at the end of the chain, you had...
And ostensibly, the taxes go back into your well-being. And
ostensibly, yeah. I'm sure that fighting plenty of people would disagree. Stuff,
but whatever. Yeah. Yeah. But at least that money is preserved, right? The $50 is still worth $50, 100, you know, transactions later. But when you siphon off a little piece each time, you actually end up at a point not too distant future where your $50 is actually only $5 of buying power because it's been, you know, sort of whittled down by all of these transactions.
There's like a 25-cent fee on every time they use a credit card.
For somebody. Maybe it's the vendor, but
yeah, somebody
I don't know
has
if it's 25 cents, but it's not nothing.
Sure. And so what are the economic systems that are absolutely 100% not communism that get us to a place that is more stable for people to live in? Is that even possible in a material universe? Or is there some sort of transcendence that needs to happen where, you know, it's the World Economic Forum of you will own nothing and be happy?
Ooh. I don't know. I come from the fintech world. That's how I made my money.
And what's fintech? Sorry.
Oh, financial technology.
Oh, right, right.
So I founded Roth Capital, my first firm, and we did, you know, hundreds of underwritings and raised billions of dollars for companies. And then my last company I did with my son is called Acorns. It's an app, and you connect your cards, and anytime you spend, we round up the change to the nearest dollar and invest that for you in the markets. And so you're getting a broad diversified portfolio. You're saving and investing every day, but it's so small, it's not painful. You know, people have a tough time starting because they never want to put thousands of dollars away. But if you're putting 50 cents away, it doesn't hurt. And so, we're up to, I think, 6 million customers and we manage about $7 billion now. And
I think the thing that people are afraid of with these automated investments is that there isn't a human heart in the decision making, in so much as, you know, if you have IRA or index funds
yeah.
These are sort of automatic processes that are making you money. Well, they're at least fighting inflation, right? So you kind of have to participate in them if you have any accumulation of savings, right? But at the same time, these companies are being selected for by their growth rather than by what they're really doing for the well-being of the society, the civilization, and so forth. And I think this is what's really scary to people. It's not that it's not a smart idea.
I think it's also hard for people to start. I think that it's just, I think Walter's totally right.
Like, oh yeah, that sounds like a really valuable service.
Dropping $1,000 into an account for somebody who has maybe, you know, $2,500 in their bank account seems absolutely insane.
But once you're involved in that investment cycle, right, as you definitely should be if you want to not lose your money to just vaporize to inflation or whatever, you should be investing your money. But the question is... Are those automated processes going to make decisions on a global scale that aren't necessarily in line with what we want to be as human beings?
Right. So, boy, there's a lot of Nobel laureates that write about this subject. And obviously, ESG is trying to answer, you know, your concerns there. And so BlackRock and, you know, Vanguard and other people have, you can buy portfolios where there's people, you know, trying to select out certain companies that might be bad. And they actually underperformed because, you know, they selected out certain of the oil and gas companies, for example, in the last cycle. And so we do all those studies and you know, not underperform too much, but a little bit. But I think some of the real studies in this area would say that there are conscious decisions going on at every level. You know, there's people that work at these companies that are just like you and me, and the majority of them are really trying to do good and make a better world and have good lives for themselves and their families. And so that's why indexes work. Most people cannot perform as well as an index because they'll flip in and out. They'll get scared when the market's down and they'll sell exactly when they shouldn't be. And so by just staying in these indexed things, you're harnessing the capitalist power of companies. And you're doing that in a way that gives returns that are over and above the inflation rate. And, you know, it's proven. You can look at all the charts all the time. So, yeah, you're right. If you just sit in cash or look at the value of your cash, it's always dwindling because governments are always going to spend more than they're taking in, you know, unless there's a revolution, then they reset for a while, and then it seems to get out of hand over long periods of time. But yeah, you get 10% returns on average per year just by being in the broad, harnessing the capitalistic system, bright minds developing new things, working for you to grow your money. You'll get a much better return than just sitting in cash.
But of course, some of the like the big FANG companies, right, are some of the biggest growing investments right now, and it's unclear whether ESG is going to be able to deal with, you know, things like the polarization of society or the isolation of individuals, and these are the strange decision making fractures that are going on right now, because it's obviously really good for a social media company to hijack your attention, but it's not necessarily good for you as a person. And there's a stark conflict of interest there, it seems like.
There's a really fascinating video from the last New Year celebration. I don't know if you saw it, but it was at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. And it's the crowd that's there watching the ball drop. And every single person in the crowd is videotaping on their phones. And so there's thousands of people that are on this alley, and every single person is holding a phone recording the exact same shot. And in the shot, you can see, you know, the crowd of everybody holding their phones, and off in the distance are the fireworks on the arc. And it just seems to kind of tie into this idea of the next phase being one of consciousness rather than being one of materialism. Because what is the metaverse if not a transition towards a consciousness-only universe?
Well, you ask great questions. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, what do you mean by consciousness-only universe?
Well, okay, so if you live in a pod and you're tied up into something that, you know, you have a feeding tube, you have a waste tube, you're living suspended in, you know, sensory deprivation
Matrix style.
Chamber. Matrix style. Yeah, right. I mean, like, I think that you have to look at the pop sci mythology or the popular mythology from science fiction in order to get a sense of what there is to be afraid of or to warrant avoiding. Because, you know, 1984 is prophetic in some sense. You look at Snowden's disclosures about the way that the government maintains records on everybody, and immediately you're like, oh, well, I wonder if that was a... Was it already inevitable in 1948 when Orwell wrote that this was the culminating arc, in the same way that it is inevitable when the Wachowski brothers are, you know, Nostradamus of 50 years in the future, that this is the thing that people go towards? Because life is really hard. Material life is really difficult. So you look around at animals and they spend all of their time gathering food. They spend all of their time maintaining their houses, maintaining their territories. there's not a lot of, you know, free time and revelry, it feels like. Everybody's kind of like always aware and casing the joint to make sure that nobody's coming after them. And I think that I look at domesticated animals, and like my cat, like she comes to live with us over the course of evolutionary history because every cat before her has been like, this is way better than like hunting rats and eating entrails. Like she gets her wet food, she gets her dry food, she has a nice place to sleep, she's asleep on the heater, she's got the windowsill, like she gets to watch the cats from inside where it's nice. And so there is this evolutionary draw of certain species towards comfort. And I feel like technology in its metaverse manifestation is the draw towards the greatest possible comfort. Every single one of your needs is met, and you allow yourself to live a life of the mind alone, where you can be everything that you want to be inside the metaverse without the dire limitations of, you know, the Pareto distribution of resources and accomplishment that is part of the physical universe.
So you're saying the metaverse to you is heaven, is the ultimate...
It's the golden age?
Golden age.
I guess
I'm looking like one step past that golden age. What's really creepy to me about this whole model is that the golden age doesn't last forever. And so, right, if the metaverse is this golden age, then it seems like the fallout from that would be the, like, somebody's going to be like, wait a second, I think we had ultimate consciousness when we were just able to ambulate around and have interactions directly with the environment.
Yeah, because, Shinal and I were thinking about this last night as we were watching The Great Year, where it's like, it's almost like it's a spiral in addition to the circle, where you're not returning necessarily to the same place where you were before, but you've somehow, you've gone up the ramp a little bit. And so there's a dislocation because now you are entering into a golden age that will descend into something that is informed by the most recent beginning of the golden age, which is different from the previous.
Or maybe not. Maybe they had the metaverse before and we just don't know about it. I mean, one thing that's really, really scary to think about, or shocking at least, is that this whole technological ramp has been going on for, what, 100 years or something? Do you think that we would see 100 years worth of... Right? We don't have any stone tablets that record what's all of this progress, what's happening right now. I mean, if this was to get all vaporized by an asteroid or something, and, you know, a few thousand human beings survived, I don't know that people would know, have any record of that in the next rise.
Yeah, like 12,000 years from now, what remains of what's written on the internet?
Right? Much of it would be destroyed in the form that we understand it. And so if they did have a form of data storage in the higher ages, what would it look like? And I talked to a scientist, a friend of mine, John Daring, physicist at Scientific Research Applications, who has some wonderful thoughts on the ideas. And he points out that today we store data in stone, silica. And if you look out in nature, any stone that exists has received all the vibrations that have gone by it. And so it essentially is a record of all the conversations held by it, all the weather that's occurred around it. However, the imprints are so subtle that we just don't have the ability to pull that out right now. But he would say that, you know, with much higher consciousness, whether or not we're turning that into some terrific technology that can pull this information out of the stone, or whether or not we just have that consciousness that can intuit the information there, that they're probably all that, all these ancient stories, all this past information is existing in the landscape all around us. And that is the higher form of storage, according to this, my friend John Daring. Isn't that a great thought?
Yeah, I mean, it is out, the truth is out there, as they say on the X-Files. It also strikes me that mythology is an interesting vessel for that. You know, I think that a lot of people in the modern age tend to look at the mythology and the religion, the proto-religions, the early religions, as being these kind of superstitious daydreams. You know, we have a tendency to look at these people from our technologically advanced position as kind of, you know, a little wacky, superstitious, you know, silly, let's say unevolved even, right? And I think that's a mistake, because I think that these myths encode real wisdom about how to live your life, let's say, or how to conduct your civilization, that people have discovered over the hundreds of thousands of years of human evolution. And the stories seem to be something that persists. Like the fact that people tell somewhat, well, in some cases, very similar stories on opposite sides of the earth from thousands of years back, some of these myths that are encoded, you know, about the bull and Orion, and I don't know, it's just, it speaks to something that's at the heart of humanity, some really, really fundamental wisdom about what it means to be a person in the world and to interact with your neighbors and to interact with the landscape and the ecosystem. It seems to be a real repository.
I agree. Yeah. You know, in the material age, when you just think everything's an evolution of just physical, pure material things, then you come up with a Darwinian philosophy. And in that philosophy, anything that came before us must be more primitive, right? And therefore, you have to denigrate the teachings of the ancients because they came before us. It's that physical approach to history is kind of at cross purposes to what we find, because some of the ancient teachings are very, very wise. One of the best books I've read on this is Hamlet's Mill by Giorgio de Santayana and Hertha von Deschen. Yeah, just brilliant scholars. You know, he was head of the history of science at MIT, and she was an anthropologist out of Frankfurt University, the Goethe School there. And they got together to find the origins of science, which is a wonderful enterprise. And so they had to look first at just what are the oldest writings we can find, where are we going to find the first math, the first physics, things like this. And that takes them to scripture, and that kind of takes them to myth and folklore all around the world. And they're the ones that discover that the ancients are really tuning into not just nature, but the sky. And they're the ones that are watching the heavens. And so they come out with one of their sort of their findings in this book, that ancient cultures were very much aware of precession, and they would tie different epochs, different eras, ages, to conditions here on Earth. And they might have had different names for them. They didn't always call them the Iron, Bronze, Silver, and Golden Age. They might have called it Ice Age, or the Wolf Age, or the Axe Age, or whatever. But then they associate that with conditions. And they said, you know, you can tell where we are in that by the position of the stars in the skies. And yeah, so they paid great attention to this higher hierarchy history, if you will.
There's a really interesting trend these days to stop the cycles. The desire to stop the cycles, I think, is central. When we talk about climate change, the idea is that we will stop climate change and will allow us to, in perpetuity, continue the project that we have begun. Let's say with Göbekli Tepe, right? So that's the last ice age. And let's say that there's a thread that runs through everything from then to now. And so we need to maintain the conditions that have allowed our societies to grow up to the degree that they have grown up. And so what we will do is we will cease change. And there's a part of me that feels like the change is really necessary in order to have evolution, in order to have development, in order to have growth. You must go through these cycles. And I feel like what we want is we want to use all of our technology and to harness it to stop things from changing. And that's a little bit freaky for me, because on one hand, I understand why. Like, you want your civilization to survive. It's great. I think that the world that we live in is in many ways better than any other world. Less slavery, less war, less starvation, better food, you know,
child mortality, right? Disease.
Yeah, like I think that we looked this up the other day. Was it, I think, 400 women in every 10,000 died in childbirth like 200 years ago? Wow. Right? It's just like, it's insane statistics. And like the kids didn't live past the age of 5. What was that?
Yeah. We've come a long way. And I think that is a sign of this cycle of the yugas. You know, I just don't think it's some sudden acceleration in evolution. Because where was evolution, you know, 2,000 years ago when the Greeks were active, 2,500 years ago? Why didn't the Greeks have a renaissance? They had all sorts of things. They geared devices, the Antikythera device, you know, completely disappears for a couple thousand years before it's rediscovered. We develop geared devices again, batteries and optics and things like this.
Yeah, and I think it's totally reasonable to think of ourselves in some sense as a progression of that same culture. I mean, I pointed it out before, but we still have very Greek-looking courthouses, capital buildings. We still use, in so much as the Romans were the ascendants to the Greeks, the descendants to the Greeks, right? We use their language and law and medicine, this Latin, right? I don't think it's a coincidence. I think in some sense we're part of this tradition of civilization, which never really disappeared. It just kind of took on new forms over the years.
Yeah, it went underground. You know, you talk about we don't like change, but every day we have big change, you know. Day gives way to night, and we go into a subconscious state, and things are dark. And every year, you know, summer gives way to fall, and fall to winter, and the earth is less productive. And it's the way on the longer scale. We just have forgotten this third motion, the procession. And I think when we understand that, we really start to put history back in perspective. And that's why I do what I do.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are aware of that fundamentally. They're aware of those bigger cycles. They see societies come and go. They see things go underground. And there's a real poetic analogy to be made there. And of course, we do the same thing. Like you said, there are these natural cycles day and night, but we also will say things like the long night of the soul, or, you know, it's very easy to look at the human life too as having like a sunrise, like, you know, the sunset retirement community or something, right? Like this is the way that we think about our lives. And so, you know, the fact that there'd be different scales of those rises and falls also seems to play out. Both in the heavens and in on our planet, in our world.
Yes, but when you've forgotten one, then it's something's bothering you. You don't know what it is. There's some angst. There's, you know, a stress. There's an anxiousness. And, you know, Graham Hancock likes to say there's an amnesia that's set in. You know, we've forgotten a big part of our history. And it's really throwing us off at this time, because if we understood where we were going, I think we'd be a lot more confident about it. But we don't.
That we want to control it. I think that that's the defining characteristic of our age. Like the technology has given us the sense that we are able to transcend the power of the cycles. And I think that it's not an accident that has emerged. The technology that allows us to do it is largely emerging from California, a place that is almost seasonless. It is, if there is a place that is eternal, it is California. If the first people that figure out how to live forever or live to be 500, they will come from California. And I think that that is not an accident. I think that there's something about this place, because we're sitting in the East Bay right now. There's something about this place that...
Well, we're not in the Bay.
Yeah, East Bay, which is the eastern part of the San Francisco Bay Area. There's something about this place that gives you the illusion that it is possible to remain forever the way that you are. Everything from the building codes to the technology that comes out here is all centered around the idea of we will master nature and we will drive it to our needs and we will take silicon and we will make it into machines that think, and we will recreate ourselves, and we will create an intelligence that we will be able to harness in order to accomplish all of these things. And forever after, we will remain in this state that is unchanging. And that, I think, is maybe the source of the tension, because you can't stop precession. You can't stop the fact that the solar system is in one place now and it will be in a different place a thousand years from now.
Or that civilizations will accumulate errors and that will lead to their collapse inevitably.
Yeah, because like biology works on the basis of, you know, you accumulate enough mutations and you die out. Organism, that's what aging is, right? And the most contemporary theories of aging is the fact that like your unit, your subunits just stop coordinating.
And properly. Institutions age similarly. This is well known.
And so if you have a position where you've basically said, these are the institutions that we will maintain and we will put all of our resources onto maintaining them forevermore, I feel like that's a huge source of tension, because people look around and they realize that renewal is necessary. And yet we have no paths to renewal that maintain the larger structures.
Yeah. So cleverness and technology can help us avoid the worst parts of the down cycles. And so we invent fire to stay warm and see during the cycle of night. And we can have blankets and houses and heaters to stay warm and get through winter, and storage facilities and things like this. But none of those stop the cycle. The cycle is driven by much larger forces, cosmic forces. We're operating within those cycles. And I think we just need that understanding that the cycle goes on, and we need to understand what each of the cycles are and then act appropriately accordingly.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. Yeah, this is really fascinating. I want to definitely try out some of these ideas, on some of my astronomer, astrophysicist friends in the future. And maybe we can check back and see what that synthesis looks like. Maybe we'll even manage to get you together with one of these characters at some point. Because there's some really open-minded folks we've talked to. Who is that gentleman in France? Do you remember his last name?
Sean Raymond.
Sean Raymond, yeah. He's a very interesting guy. And I'm looking to make better friends with him in the future. He does these sandbox modelings where he'll try on different configurations of solar systems, try on different, you know, if we move this planet here, or if this star passes by at this distance, well, how will that change the orbits? And he's managed to publish quite a bit on this. Totally hypothetical. Nobody's bothering him because he's the first to admit that, you know, he's just playing around. He's not saying this happened in the past. It's just like, well, what if it did? What would that have looked like? And so it'd be fun to talk to Sean and maybe get you guys together.
Yeah.
I'd welcome that. Yeah. Somebody out there should go win a Nobel Prize on this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Maybe that's part of the problem too. I don't know how, and I worry about Nobel Prizes because it doesn't seem like there's much room to change your mind after you've gotten a Nobel Prize.
No, I just want to understand history and what drives it. And it's driven by much bigger things. And I think it's important that we don't forget the cycles, you know, because it really informs who we are, where we came from. And much of this knowledge is embedded in ancient wisdom and the saints and sages of the East. And there's a lot we can learn right there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Where can folks find out more about your work?
Our main website is the Binary Research Institute, .org. And it's some of our papers and proofs and things like that. The math is there, if you will. And then we also have a site called Lost Star. It's based on my book, Lost Star of Myth and Time. And we're working on another documentary to sort of be a sequel to the one that you saw last night, The Great Year, and working on a sort of a feature film project about this whole thing too, just to get it to the masses. You know, it seems like ideas can almost get out there easier if you just put the wrapper of fiction on them and, you know, you convince people we're much greater than we are. If we can all see superheroes that can do it and things like this. So that's the way we're trying to get some of these ideas out there.
Absolutely. That's very cool.
That's smart. Cool. Well, thanks for coming by. It's been very eye-opening. Definitely.
Hey, thank you.
Alerted me to a problem I wasn't aware of, and I'm stoked. So thank you.
Real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Just a joy. I hope we meet you in person someday too.
Yes, definitely. Let's make that happen. Where are you located at physically, by the way? Remind me one more time.
I'm about 500 miles south of you in Newport Beach.
Okay, yeah, could definitely. We're always traveling up and down the coast here.
Good. Look forward to it. Okay.
All right, take care. Have a great rest of your day.
Take care. Likewise.
Bye-bye, everybody.